This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Joshua Johnson. What happens when an unstoppable force comes up against an immovable object? All of us here in Washington might be about to find out. House Democrats are vowing to plow ahead with their impeachment inquiry into President Trump, despite the Trump administration vowing not to cooperate with the inquiry at all. Last night, at a big campaign rally in Minneapolis, Trump showed no sign of backing down.
The wretched Washington swamp has been trying to nullify the results of a truly great and democratic election.
We'll talk about that and a whole lot more on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in that wretched Washington swamp to help hash it all out is Tolu Olorunipa. He's a White House reporter for The Washington Post. He's here with me in the studio. Tolu, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Ested Herndon is a national politics reporter at the New York Times. He joins us from NPR in New York. Ested, welcome.
Thank you.
And Abby Phillips is here in the studio. She's a political correspondent with CNN. Abby, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's dive right in with Capitol Hill. U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gary Sondland, was supposed to testify before impeachment investigators early this week. But not only did the Trump administration keep Sondland from testifying, it said in a letter to Congress that it would not be cooperating with the impeachment inquiry at all. Abby, can they do that?
Well, a lot of legal experts agree that they probably can't, and that this document that came from the White House counsel's office really shocked a lot of people, including some Republicans, because of how thin the legal standing of some of their arguments were just on its face. The idea that that the White House can simply choose not to participate in an impeachment inquiry just flies in the face of the Constitution, which expressly gives the House of Representatives that power. And we're also starting to see, you know, some movement in terms of what might actually be happening on Capitol Hill. Democrats have moved instead of working with some of these people to get voluntary testimony, they've moved to subpoenas to compel them to testify. And I think what we're starting to see is some of those very individuals who were like Sondland, who was blocked this week, now being willing to testify under the duress of a subpoena, because the legal implications for defying a subpoena for those witnesses are probably more than they're willing to bear. People can go to jail for defying a congressional subpoena. I think a lot of people are not willing to go that far.
Tolu, what is the Trump administration's goal then of releasing that letter?
Well, it was as much a political document as a legal document. You heard a lot of political arguments in that 8-page letter to Nancy Pelosi and the congressional leaders talking about how Democrats want to overturn the results of the 2016 election and how they are using this impeachment inquiry to try to interfere and influence the results of the 2020 election. They said in the letter that President Trump has a job to do. So it's part of trying to make this argument to the American people that President Trump is focused on his duties and his responsibilities as commander in chief and not on what he calls a witch hunt and what he calls presidential harassment. So they're trying to make the argument. Right now, we do see polling starting to move in the Democrats' favor to show that people do want this impeachment inquiry. They do want to get to the bottom of what happened. They do want to find out whether the president was involved in any misconduct. But the president and his allies and his White House counsel are trying to make the political argument that this is a waste of time, that this is not something that he should be impeached over, and that Democrats have wanted to impeach him from the beginning of the time that he took office, and this is the chance that they're actually taking. So it does appear that they're trying to make a political argument to the American people as much as they are making a legal argument, and even more than they're making a legal argument that the president doesn't have to respond to or cooperate at all with this impeachment inquiry.
Instead, do you expect more people to respond to these subpoenas?
Well, I think that's going to be that remains to be seen. We have not seen the White House kind of in any way show any inkling to cooperate with this House impeachment inquiry. We seem to be careening towards a kind of constitutional step where the House will have to try to flex their muscle in all kind of legal realms, including subpoenas, to try to get answers from this White House. But, you know, as Tolu said, the White House is making a political argument that the impeachment inquiry that emanates from the House due to their legal standing doing is one that they don't have to cooperate with. And that's one that for this moment has the support of the base. The White House is not feeling any kind of internal pressure from Republicans or from Republican base voters to work with Democrats, because they have kind of taken the president's view that the Democratic impeachment inquiry is one that is political. Now, it's important to make a distinction that it's not the public at large. We have seen public polling say that the American people want this to be looked into. But as we've seen throughout this kind of administration, the White House and the Republican senators have been willing to eschew public opinion when it seems like they have the support most principally of their base. And so I can't say whether we're going to see these subpoenas adhered to in the future, but I do know that we are kind of going and escalating toward a kind of more fundamental constitutional moment. Because if the White House shows no willingness, then that puts at a willingness to work with the House, that puts us at a rock and a hard place.
So the Republican allies have told Trump that Sondland's testimony would actually be good for him. Abby, would that actually be good for President Trump?
It depends on what Sondland has to say. I do think some Republicans believe Sondland to be pretty loyal to the president. He was a major donor to President Trump's campaign and was appointed as ambassador to the EU in part for that reason. But the trouble for President Trump, and I think the reason that the White House moved at the last minute to block his testimony, is because Sondland had direct access to President Trump on the issue of Ukraine. He did not go through a normal State Department interagency process to develop policy around Ukraine. He was calling President Trump directly and talking to him about what the president wanted from Ukraine in exchange for a phone call or a meeting. And the details of those conversations might actually be damning to this investigation and to the president. Now, Sondland has a reason to defend the president, in part really to protect himself, but I'm not sure the facts are on the president's side here in this case, and I think that's a really key reason why he has not testified. That being said, we're already getting some indications that Sondland might be willing to testify under subpoena next week, in spite of the State Department making it clear that they don't want him to.
Tolu, President Trump also said about a week ago that he would, quote, always cooperate and, quote, work together with Democrats. What happened?
That fell apart pretty quickly. I mean, obviously, the president often says things that that turn out to not be how he actually behaves. It did sound like it was just a soundbite with the president saying, yes, I cooperate. I'm doing what I need to do. But based on this letter from the White House counsel, it's very clear that the president and the White House are taking a very, very absolutist position, that the president is not subject to this kind of oversight, that he does not have to comply with these subpoenas, that he does not have to respond when Congress asks for information, that he is above this entire process, which the White House believes is an overly partisan, overly political process. So I would be surprised if the president shows that he's likely to comply with any of this, in part because I think they've made a political calculation at the White House that the Democrats are going to go forward with impeachment anyways. There's no benefit in giving them more information or even helping them get to the bottom of what happened, because as Abby said, in many cases, the facts as they've come out so far with text messages and the White House transcript of the call do not yield positive results for the president. So they're likely to lock down as much information as they can. We'll see if the courts weigh in one way or the other. But they've made the political calculation that impeachment is going forward anyway, so we're not going to support any part of it. We're going to respond in a way that shows that we're making a political argument, which is that we don't have to be a part of this at all, and that we can make a political message to our base that we are being harassed by the Democrats.
Aaron writes, so if Trump didn't do anything wrong, why is he hiding everything? People who refuse to cooperate usually have bad things to hide. And then in parentheses puts impeachment. President Trump also insisted in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos that Article 2 of the Constitution allows him to do whatever he wants. Article 2 is the part that deals with executive privilege. Abby, can we get a fact check on this claim here?
The Constitution does not allow the president to do whatever he wants. However, I will say this has been President Trump's argument from the beginning. And now, unlike at the beginning of his administration, he has someone at the Justice Department in Attorney General Bill Barr who actually kind of agrees with that logic. Bill Barr has staked his entire legal career on the idea that that the executive has a lot of power. In fact, far more power than many legal experts would like to say. And so as a result, we've seen a lot of legal opinions coming out of the Trump Justice Department that support this claim that executive power is almost universal, that it applies broadly and widely to almost all circumstances, whereas the counterargument that I think most mainstream legal experts make is that executive privilege in particular is actually quite limited, and it's limited to protect the president's conversations and decision-making abilities, but it's not a complete carte blanche for the president to do literally whatever he wants. And Nancy Pelosi has taken that on directly and said, no one is above the law. The president certainly isn't. And the mechanism in the Constitution to enforce that principle is actually, in fact, impeachment, which is given to the House of Representatives.
Very quickly, Ested, Marion is asking, can you explain the Attorney General's action in the impeachment issues? Just very quickly, Ested, who is the Attorney General that she's talking about? Can you tell what role he's playing?
Well, Bill Barr is the Attorney General. He was an appointee of President Trump a couple years ago, and he has both in the Russian collusion question and in this one played a very integral role. This is someone who has kind of used his power in the Democrats, kind of version of events to shield the president. In this instance, we had in the transcript of the call and in other instances, folks saying that the president was using Attorney General Barr as a kind of point person to do some investigation.
Right back,
Vice President Biden.
To that, coming up in the Friday News Roundup, we're speaking with Ested Herndon of the New York Times, Tolu Olorunipa of the Washington Post, and Abby Phillip of CNN. I'm Kimberly Adams. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams in for Joshua Johnson. We're talking about the latest impeachment inquiry news with Ested Herndon of the New York Times, Tolu Olorunipa from the Washington Post, and Abby Phillip of CNN. I have a few more questions I'd like to get to there, but before I do, we wanted to mention the wildfires and power outages in California. Millions of people in Northern California were without power yesterday, and some remain so after a series of intentional outages from utility provider Pacific Gas and Electric. PG&E decided to cut power after forecasts predicted dry, gusty winds that could down power lines and start a fire. The outages come a year after a massive fire in Paradise, California, killed 85 people. That fire was later blamed on PG&E equipment. Meanwhile, a fast-moving wildfire near Los Angeles consumed more than 4,000 acres overnight, according to the LA Times. Ested, let's get back to the inquiry with you. Alan, I'll reread that question from Marion. She says, can you please explain to me the Attorney General's actions in the impeachment issue? I know he is obviously conservative and even partisan, but I would have thought that he would have been a defender of the rule of law. She's referring there to Attorney General Bill Barr. Ested?
Yeah, that's kind of a question that even a lot of Democrats are having right now. Bill Barr is someone who has acted principally within the president's interest. He has had a kind of legal vision of one that oftentimes seems to protect the president. Remember in the collusion question with Robert Mueller when he was putting out the report, it was Attorney General Barr who took the step of making the summary and releasing that public, which initially shaped public opinion here on the impeachment. The Ukraine call and question that has kind of led us to this moment. It's again Attorney General Barr who was playing an integral role on the call that kind of kicked this off. You have President Trump telling the Ukrainian president that it was something that the Hunter Biden, Joe Biden political investigation was something that Attorney General Barr would be looking into. We had that again. Some reporting has backed that up. So that is kind of an open question. We've seen Democrats Democrats try to seize on that. I mean, earlier today, Senator Kamala Harris called for Attorney General Barr to recuse himself from the Ukraine investigation, and we're going to see increasing calls from that. There's even been some calls from Democrats to try to impeach the Attorney General. Their argument there is that he is acting within the in the interest of the president rather than following the rule of law, like the reader lays out. We have not seen that be a kind of consensus across the board, or even kind of more centrist Democrats call for that. But there is a frustration with Attorney General Barr, partly because in kind of key critical moments, he does seem to be at least share the same view of the president, where his actions are almost inherently constitutional.
Phil emails, looks like the high and mighty Rudy Giuliani may need to spill the beans or he might find himself in front of a judge. This is one of the stories that's been developing, that two associates of Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani have been arrested on campaign finance charges. Tolu, how does this tie into this ever-widening story?
Yeah, this scandal is definitely widening. As you said, the president's first personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is behind bars right now for campaign finance problems and other legal challenges. Now his second personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is in legal crosshairs, in part because these two associates were charged with campaign finance violations, basically funneling money from foreign entities and trying to get them into the U.S. political system. These are donors to President Trump's super PAC. These are donors to a lot of Republican politicians who were working behind the scenes with Rudy Giuliani on a lot of this Ukraine stuff, trying to get the former ambassador to Ukraine ousted, trying to push forward different types of personal deals with the natural gas company over in Ukraine. And Rudy Giuliani's personal business interests and his legal representation of President Trump and his, you know, sort of political ends seem to be all merging in this case. And the fact that all of those things are happening at the same time gives Democrats a lot of room to run in terms of investigating what Rudy Giuliani was doing, and also figuring out his role in this Ukraine scandal. It's possible that he was pushing foreign policy on behalf of the State Department at a time when the foreign policy that he was pushing was at odds with what the U.S. government had been doing in the past, at odds with the fact that Congress had put forward hundreds of millions of dollars in aid that was supposed to go to Ukraine that was being held up in part because by the president at the urging of Rudy Giuliani, who was trying to push for investigations of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. So all of these things are fodder for Democrats to investigate at a time when Rudy Giuliani may be also being investigated by the Southern District of New York, which he an office he used to lead, which just charged a couple of his associates and maybe looking at his conduct as well.
And since this story isn't complicated enough, let's add a few more players. House Democrats have issued subpoenas for both of those two associates of Rudy Giuliani's, as well as Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. How is Rick Perry involved in all of this, Abby?
Well, Rick Perry has acknowledged that he played a role in asking President Trump to engage with Ukraine's President Zelensky, asking him to make a phone call to Zelensky. Now, Perry has made it clear that he believes that his conduct had absolutely nothing to do with what Rudy Giuliani was up to. He says that he had no idea about all of this stuff involving Joe Biden, and that what he was trying to do was encourage the United States to maintain a geopolitical relationship with Ukraine, helping Ukraine gain energy independence away from Russia, which is a foreign policy goal of the United States. But Perry is involved in this, and Democrats want to know what he knew about what Giuliani was pushing, and what at the crux of this is, were there terms and conditions given to the Ukrainians saying to them essentially, you can't have a phone call or you can't have a meeting until you do certain things as it relates to Joe Biden? That's what Democrats are trying to find out.
Benuto tweets, why doesn't the House do a formal vote to authorize an impeachment inquiry instead of how they've gone about it? Astead, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, this has been a kind of developing question. This is something that Republicans are pushing for. They want Democrats to have to go on the record, and they want Democrats to have to formally open an impeachment inquiry. This is a decision from Speaker Pelosi, frankly, to get all their ducks in a row. The kind of explanation you're getting from Democrats is one that they want to use their powers to kind of answer some of these difficult questions, kind of untangle the web that we've laid out here, and then they want to bring it to a formal impeachment vote. We have seen Speaker Pelosi be very, very careful in each step here because she wants it to kind of be ironclad, particularly as Democrats go into a critical 2020 year. Now, Republicans are saying that it's a way for Democrats to kind of sidestep taking a tough impeachment vote, particularly for some of those swing district House members who have still, there's a couple of them who have still not really weighed in here. And Speaker Pelosi has been trying to protect those folks. But what we do know right now is that there are a majority of House members who have come out for impeachment. So whether bringing it to a full vote is a formality or not is kind of an open question. But the explanation we get from Democratic leadership is that they want to use their investigative powers first to answer the open questions and then kind of take the next steps on the impeachment political process.
And at the time when President Trump needs the support of his Republican allies the most, he surprised military advisors and congressional Republicans by withdrawing American troops out of northern Syria, leaving our Kurdish allies there to fend for themselves against Turkey. Tolu, what's the background here?
Yeah, that decision made a lot of Republicans break ranks with the president. And we don't see that often. We don't see Republicans speak out publicly and say that the president did something wrong or that they disagree with him. But his decision to pull out troops from northeast Syria at a time when Turkey was about to go in with the U.S. allied Kurds really being at the mercy of the Turkish forces, that really rubbed a lot of Republicans the wrong way. You have to remember that the Kurds were a key partner in the fight against ISIS over the past several years, and Republicans believe that abandoning the Kurds in the sort of the very abrupt way that the president did not only undermines U.S. credibility, but also will make it difficult to sustain the gains that were made against ISIS and may allow terrorists to escape from prisons that were being run by the Kurds. So there are a number of reasons why Republicans felt free to openly sort of castigate the president for this decision. We haven't seen that very often, and it's very interesting to compare and contrast what Republicans are saying about impeachment and about Ukraine and the call that the president had with the Ukrainian president. Several Republicans have been unwilling to comment on that, have been dodging that question. But when it came to this Syria decision, a lot of Republicans felt very bold, and they felt that the need to make a very bold statement about what the president had done and how much they disagreed with it. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see not only those tough words, but also actions from Democrats and Republicans to sanction Turkey, to show their displeasure with what President Trump did, and to make it very clear that on this policy issue that they're willing to break with him, even if they're standing by him on impeachment and on this Ukraine issue.
It does seem to have the feeling of Republicans trying to let some air out of the balloon, that they don't feel that they're politically covered in criticizing the president on the Ukraine scandal, but that they are showing that they're willing to do it on other issues and that they're not just following the president blindly. But at the same time, folks like Senator Lindsey Graham have staked his entire relationship with President Trump on his ability to influence Trump on foreign policy. Graham has said, you know, I golf with the president, I support him on these other issues in order for me to have, a voice in his ear at moments like this. But on this issue, really, which is in some ways in the Syria debate, kind of the entire ball game, Lindsey Graham really lost in this case. And he's responded to that by criticizing the president. But it really leads to the question, has it been worth it to Lindsey Graham to defend President Trump on all of these other issues, but then lose in a really big way on one of the major issues about U.S. policy in the Middle East? This relates to Russia, it relates to Iran, and it relates to Turkey. And Republicans at this moment, they claim that they're going to try to do something, but President Trump is the commander in chief. He has the ability to set policy on this issue.
I'm Kimberly Adams. This is 1A. Let's move on to the Democratic 2020 race. Former Vice President Biden, who has been targeted by President Trump in a series of conspiracy theories about he and his son's involvement in Ukraine that we've been talking about, he spoke about impeachment for the first time this week. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
To preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached. That's not only because of what he's done. To answer whether he has committed acts of sufficient to warrant impeachment is obvious.
Instead, why is Biden calling for President Trump's impeachment now, as opposed to saying something when Speaker Pelosi initially announced the formal impeachment inquiry?
You can go even before that. On the 2020 side, which is where I spend most of my time, impeachment has kind of been agreed upon question for months before Speaker Pelosi got there. Senator Elizabeth Warren kicked it off earlier in the summer. Most of the other candidates seem to follow her. It's Vice President Biden who has been the most, frankly, the last to get there. Now, that happens for a couple reasons, according to what we know from Vice President Biden and his team. One is that this is someone who takes that kind of institutional responsibility very seriously. He has served in the Senate much longer than these other candidates and considers himself a kind of institutional champion. And frankly, when the other senators were calling for before the Ukraine situation related to Russia and the like, the vice president was uncomfortable going there. Now, as this has gotten more personal for him, as the president has started targeting him and his son, we've seen the campaign kind of wait a couple weeks to really jump in the fray. There's been a lot of reporting that they were kind of slow to hit back, and even some of his rivals and donors were kind of surprised at that. But we see them trying to go on the offensive now. They've attacked. They've reached out to media companies trying to get them to not have on Rudy Giuliani and other folks who talk, speak up those conspiracies against the vice president and his son. And they're going at President Trump directly. They held a speech about the president's character. And then it leads up to this impeachment moment. Now, this is basically a concession from Vice President Biden that the other candidates in the field, where they were, was the place to be. And he has arrived to it at this point. Now, the question will be going forward. Do voters, Democratic voters who overwhelmingly want to see this and see this impeachment inquiry happen, do they credit Vice President Biden for getting there, or do they look to some of those rivals who have gotten there before him? Remember, he's doing this now not as the front runner almost anymore, when the kind of polling averages has put Elizabeth Warren above him. So he's trying to go on the offensive to punch back and get himself in the race.
Right. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren, who has been gaining ground on Vice President Biden. And a Quinnipiac poll released this week has Warren at the top of the field with 27% of the registered Democratic vote. Biden is currently in second place with 25%. Abby, do you think that Biden speaking out on impeachment now is sort of part of that effort to deal with this?
I think it's part of the Biden campaign's broader effort to deal with Trump in general. This is a really tricky issue for him. It involves his son, which is something that he is very sensitive about. And one of the reasons that it seems that he's been unwilling to go this far is because Biden's whole campaign is predicated on his appeal to moderate voters. And while he wants to win the Democratic primary, I think he wants to maintain the position that he's not just rushing to judgment on impeachment. But at this point, you've started to hear the feedback from some Democrats who lived through the Hillary Clinton email scandal and saw how that affected her campaign all throughout. And the feedback that they've given the Biden folks is you have to get ahead of this. You cannot just sit back and allow Trump to define the conversation around you and your son. And so I do think that him coming out on impeachment is an effort to not just be a bystander in this situation, to show Democratic voters that he's willing and able to fight back, and also to push back on what I think is starting to simmer beneath the surface, this feeling that perhaps even if Biden didn't do anything wrong, the issue in and of itself becomes something of an Achilles heel. He has to fight back against that before it starts to take root among Democrats who still have PTSD from the Clinton era, when they felt like the emails scandal really undermined voters' ability to trust Hillary going all the way to Election Day in 2016.
Bruce writes, both Biden and Warren have baggage that they will not overcome. Trump will be all over it. And Samantha writes, Bernie needs to team up with Elizabeth Warren as her running mate. The Dems need to combine their powers and pool their talents. Coming up, the NBA goes on the defensive after a tweet from one team's general manager sets off a wave of anger in China. It's the Friday News Roundup with Ested Herndon of The New York Times, Tolu Olorunipa of The Washington Post, and Abby Phillip of CNN. We're back in a minute. Stay close. So back to the 2020 race. Tolu, Senator Bernie Sanders announced changes to his campaigning style earlier this week as he recovers from his heart attack last week. What is going to change about his campaign?
Well, he did say he's going to change the way, the nature of his campaign and try to slow things down a little bit. We did see him put out an ad to his supporters, a video response, sort of trying to be in front of his supporters via video instead of actually having to go out on the campaign trail. He did walk back some of his earlier comments where he at first said he was going to slow down his campaign. Eventually, he said he meant to say that he's going to start more slowly and then build up. We will get a good chance to see what he looks like and how much stamina he has during the debate next week. He has said that he feels good and he's happy to be out there on the campaign trail, and he's going to be at the debate, which is going to be, you know, probably a good 3 hours where he's going to have to stand up on stage and answer questions. And a lot of people will be watching to see what kind of condition he's in. He is 78 years old. There have been all of these questions about his health and the fact that he did have this health scare with his heart attack. And it took a little bit of time for the information to come out, will cause a lot of not only pundits, but also voters to sort of scrutinize him and see how much he's able to run a very vigorous campaign. It's not easy to run for president. It takes a lot. It takes a toll on the body. So people will be waiting to see whether or not he can run all the way through for the next 13 months or whether they should decide to cast their support with another candidate. So he's under a lot of pressure to show that not only does he have the right policies, but he can also, show voters that he can run this race at 78 years old and it can be an octogenarian president, which we haven't had before, and be able to carry out the rigors of the presidency. So people will be watching very closely to see whether or not he's showing that kind of vigor on the campaign trail.
Michael is watching. He writes on Facebook, it would be best for all if he would just drop his candidacy and connect and support one of the others. He has some great ideas, but no plans or a way to make most of them happen. His time has come and gone. Ested, what does all of this mean for the viability of the Sanders campaign going forward?
Well, we have seen Senator Sanders kind of flatline for the last couple months in the campaign. He has kind of maintained the kind of third place status. Senator Warren has overtaken him to become kind of chief rivals with Vice President Biden. Now, it's important to note that this campaign is not going anywhere. This is one that really believes that they are the strongest, particularly on a single-payer healthcare system, and that that is an issue that Americans will come around to. And frankly, they have gotten some good signs in the last couple of months. Politically, they've had the largest fundraising quarter of anyone, any candidate in the race this quarter. They have that. They've done that with 1 million donors across the country. That's a larger donor base than any other campaign has. So they look at that as signs that they have a kind of community, a political base that might be outside traditional polling or might be outside traditionally punditry window, but one that is strong for Senator Sanders. We will see. He is not kind of excited, that same level of energy that we saw a couple years ago. And we have seen Senator Warren particularly able to have a kind of foot in both the progressive lanes and cobble over some of those Clinton supporters to build a kind of bigger, at least polling constituency. This is still a state-by-state contest, though. So you have to go from Iowa to New Hampshire to Nevada to South Carolina. And in those kind of one-by-one contests, that's where Senator Sanders' campaign thinks that they have a real shot. They think that when you put them isolated in those states, they have people who have been maybe less tuned into the race so far, but still have those good feelings about him from a couple years ago and will come out when it matters. So that's the kind of theory of the case from the Sanders campaign. Clearly, it remains to be seen. But, you know, to the question of dropping out, I can assure you that's not something they're thinking about.
Your comment about the states leads to a comment we have from Aaron, who says, I wish pundits and press people would quit talking about national polls and instead look at polls in the first four or five primary states. Right now, those polls matter a lot more than any national poll. Abby, between Sanders' health and Biden getting tied up in the impeachment news, how is the dynamic of the race changing overall?
You're seeing really a steady Elizabeth Warren rise. And that's been, you know, to some people, it might seem like a surprise, but it has been building for months and months. And she's benefiting from Biden losing a little bit of steam and from Bernie Sanders losing a little bit of steam. And she's pulling from, surprisingly, some voters that some of the other candidates like Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar might have thought that they would get these, as Estead mentioned, former Clinton voters who are coming over to her side. So that's really the dominant dynamic in this race right now. And it's a question of whether or not both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden can regain any of the momentum that they've lost in time to do well in these early states. I think the writer, the questioner, is absolutely right that the states do matter more than really anything else right now. But even when you look at the state level polls, you're seeing some of the same dynamics that we're seeing in national polls. You're seeing Elizabeth Warren leading in Iowa. You're seeing her leading in New Hampshire, and you're seeing her gain traction in South Carolina. And that is going to be a really important thing to watch. People have questioned, can Elizabeth Warren win over black voters? Well, that's a question Elizabeth Warren is trying to answer. She's gaining a little bit of steam. Is it enough to overtake Biden? That's something that we'll be watching really, really closely.
All right, let's move on to another topic. China made major news stateside this week. Several businesses are in trouble with the country over current protests in Hong Kong. The general manager for the NBA's Houston Rockets tweeted, quote, fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong, which is not exactly what the Chinese government wanted to hear. He deleted the tweet, but the damage was done. Instead, I'm going to go back to you. How did China and the NBA respond?
Yeah, this has been one of the very interesting kind of non-Trump Washington storylines of the last couple of weeks. You had the general manager Morey and the Rocket from the Houston Rockets tweet that out. Now, it's important to remember the Houston Rockets and China have a long-standing relationship. This goes back to Yao Ming being a Rockets player and kind of developing as the first one of the biggest global superstars in the NBA. Now, China immediately suspended its business relationship with the Houston Rockets after that tweet, and you had an immediate fallout from the NBA. You had apologies from James Harden, the star Rocket player, and also the owner of the Rockets issued an apology. Morey, the general manager, issued a statement that did not walk his back, but said that he was sorry that it caused so much friction. And then the NBA releases something saying that while it stands for free speech and or stands for people expressing their own views, if they found it regrettable that it had upset their business partners in China. Now, again, the NBA finds itself in a unique position here. This is a league that has encouraged its players to speak out on politics and has encouraged a kind of branding of themselves as the League of Social Justice. And so now when that kind of branding is coming into conflict with its international business relationships, you see a real tension that is not going to be easy to square. Now, the NBA had some preseason games over in China, and journalists were asking players about this issue. And the NBA was using kind of its league officials to clamp down on those questions. You have folks taken out of the stadium for putting out signs that say Free Hong Kong. this is not going to go anywhere. China is such a big market, not only for the NBA, but other companies. And as China wields its influence to try to make sure the political messages trend in their direction, these institutions are going to have to make a choice. Do we stand for kind of values that like free speech and democracy, even if they come in conflict to some of our partners? Or do we kind of make sure that we are placating everyone here at the table, even if that incurs some political backlash, as we've seen the NBA get this week?
Jenny writes, I'm interested to see how the populace in China reacts to having their favorite sport blocked. Apparently, this is a very big market for basketball, and now they are being blocked from watching, so perhaps they will become aware of what is happening in Hong Kong. Ryan writes, I have been completely disgusted by the NBA and the NBA channel on XM Radio. They keep saying how it's a business and that they need to walk a fine line. Other American businesses have faced similar pressure from China. Apple and Google removed an app from their stores that tracks police activity in Hong Kong, and game company Activision Blizzard banned a professional player based out of Hong Kong for voicing support for the protesters. Tolu, why are we seeing more and more companies take such stringent action when it comes to China and Hong Kong?
Well, that's what the Chinese government is demanding. And if these companies want access to the Chinese market, 1.4 billion people, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars on the line, these companies are willing to bite their tongue and really bow to the whims of the Chinese government, which their system there is much more authoritarian. It's not a clear democracy where voters can say what they want. Businesses that want to engage with China have to do the bidding of the Chinese government. And the Chinese government has taken a very hard line on issues involving Hong Kong or Taiwan or anything that would question the sovereignty of the Chinese government. And they've said that any U.S. business that wants to enter into this market and have access to all of these billions of people, hundreds of millions of people, and billions of dollars in potential revenue, all of these companies have to play by our rules. And we're seeing a number of companies willing to do that, willing to make that compromise. It's not the same as the system here where there is complete freedom of speech and, government can't directly tell companies what to say. And voters will have a say in voting out politicians if they block a company over something that they say. So these companies are having, as Ted said, they're having to make this choice. And we are seeing a lot of them decide to make a choice that maybe is more beneficial to their shareholders and not necessarily in line with U.S. values. But that is a decision that a lot of them are making.
I'm Kimberly Adams. You're listening to 1A. Another story, there's a study out of UC Berkeley on tax rates that reveals that for the first time in American history, billionaires pay a lower tax rate than the working class. According to the study, it's a little over a percentage point lower. Abby, what does this tell us about the country today?
It is sort of the big headline that I think tells you a lot about some of the undercurrents in American politics. And I would argue they're both the undercurrents that brought Donald Trump to where he is, and also that undergird the candidacies of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, this feeling that there's an inherent unfairness in the system. Now, you know, Democrats say that what Donald Trump has in fact done is do a more traditional Republican thing since he was elected to office, which is pass the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that they say really realign the tax system in favor of the wealthy. But I think as we go into this election cycle, what you're seeing Warren and Sanders speaking to is the sense that even while the economy feels generally pretty good, it's going pretty well, a lot of people feel like the system is still not working for them, that they want a fundamental change in the system that really allows some of the wealthiest people, very few people, mind you, to pay relatively little in taxes, and the rest of the country, working class people and poor people, paying about the same amount that they've paid for decades. A lot of people think that's unfair. How President Trump will respond to the fact that his governance has differed from the way that he campaigns in 2016, we actually haven't seen yet because he's not been up on a debate stage having to duke it out on these policy issues. But it's going to be an important question once we get into the general election.
Instead, is there any indication that Trump's supporters associate him with this kind of inequality?
Not really. I was just at a kind of Trump supporters big rally in Arizona, a kind of organic, it called itself Trump Stock, actually, Woodstock for Trump fans. And one of the things that kind of emanates from that is the economic questions that maybe brought these folks to Trump's campaign initially. The populism he was espousing at the time, he was indicting the kind of crony capitalism, he was calling it, of the Jeb Bushes of the world. And Washington, frankly, the drain the swamp qualities, they see enough evidence that he's doing things on that issue, although the specifics are often light. I would remind folks that that economic concerns and cultural concerns are intertwined for most people, including the supporters. So when you ask Trump supporters, okay, well, what did he has he done to drain the swamp? The answers can be unclear, but they will point to other things he's done that are also on the top of their interest list. Things like immigration, things like restricting refugees, things like. Just the general kind of the hits that the administration, I always say they play the hits that they on Fox News and others about the First Step Act and about tax cuts and the like. So it's not necessarily that the tax cuts that happened weren't in line with the populist values that he expressed initially, but that he was just getting something done. And that's what you hear often from those supporters. Now, it will be interesting to see if the nominee from the Democratic side is someone like Elizabeth Warren. Can they peel off some of that support by going to those communities and saying he did not live up to the values of kind of working class values he espoused initially? We don't know that just yet, but the majority of the supporters are sticking with them, not just because of the economic concerns, but because of cultural ones.
All right. And before we go, just very quickly, Simone Biles has reached another level of gymnastics fame with not one, but two new moves named after her, which we are very excited to hear about. She executed a triple-triple during her flow routine and a double-double dismount on the balance beam. A big thanks to our guest, Ested Herndon, a national politics reporter at the New York Times, Tolu Olorunipa, a White House reporter for the Washington Post, and Abby Phillip here in studio, a political correspondent with CNN. And remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app. 1A's lead engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the 1A.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University, and distributed by NPR. I'm Kimberly Adams. Joshua's back on Monday. This is 1A.
Got that rainbow feel, but the rainbow has a beard.